grab some popcorn and a favorite chair. The love of movies is why we're here. Press play and don't delay. Let Phil be our guide to a cinematic day. Phil at the movies, from the silver screen to his podcast stream. Phil's covering every movie dream. Phil at the movies. Phil at the movies.
Afraid of the big black bat. In an uncertain world, in a chaotic time, justice wears a mask.
And hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Phil at the Movies. I'm your host, Phil Walsh, and this is show number 166 of this ongoing podcast that is always for the love of movies. And based on that little tease, you can probably guess what today's episode is about, but this is no ordinary review. This is an episode dedicated to acknowledging and frankly celebrating the film Batman Forever, which turns 30 next month. It's hard to believe. 30 years of Batman Forever, a film that frankly continues to grow in fascination and appreciation, particularly among fans of the comic book character. But as I said, today is a review and retrospective on the third Batman film. This was the first film to depart with Michael Keaton and Tim Burton and bring in Joel Schumacher and Val Kilmer for the director and Batman duo. Before that, let me just say, as always, thank you for tuning in each and every Friday to this show. I appreciate your support and, most important of all, your friendship. And lastly, if you could, please rate and review this podcast on Apple, if that is where you're listening, as well as sharing it with fellow cinema buffs and movie fans alike. Really helps with the pesky algorithms and building awareness, and continues to grow the show to an even bigger audience. As I say, you know, movies will go on, and so will this show. 166 episodes and going strong, all because of you, the listeners, the friends of Phil at the Movies, and I am forever grateful to each and every one of you. On June 16th, 1995, Batman did indeed return in Batman Forever, the third entry in the popular comic book movie franchise that started in 1989 with the seminal Tim Burton, Michael Keaton superhero classic Batman. After the parental backlash to Batman Returns over McDonald's Happy Meal toys and prototype Karens crying about the darker and more adult-themed material in Batman Returns, the series got a makeover, and in the days before the term was in vogue, a reboot of sorts. While there were hints to the other two films, more on that later, Batman Forever was a fresh start, an attempt to reinvent the franchise under the direction of the late great Joel Schumacher. The film celebrates 30 years next month and is still very much beloved and truly celebrated. Yes, it's a slightly campier, but still fun entry in the Batman world, teeming with psychological complexity that delivers a comic book movie come to life. Now, as I said, the film came out in 1995, and so at the time of its premiere, I would have been just shy of 4 years old. Again, really going back in the time machine here with this one. So I didn't actually see this film in theaters, sadly enough. The first time I saw this movie was when it was on VHS release, and so this would have probably been around Christmas time of 1995. So I was four and a half at this point, and certainly caught up in the new wave of Batmania, so to speak. Again, I was born after 1989. I was much too young for Batman Returns in 1992. So Batman Forever was, in a lot of ways, my first real introduction to the movie version of the character, though my first ever experience with the character actually was with the Adam West movie that I had caught on a rerun. I remember that was kind of a big deal the first time I saw it. But this was kind of the first one that jumped out to me. And then, of course, I saw the first Burton and Keaton film, and, of course, Batman returned sometime after, and just being dazzled by those films, especially Batman Returns. But Batman Forever was a time where, again, Batmania was at its peak, so to speak, and I remember I had all of the action figures, the Batmobile, the Batcave playset. I mean, I had a room full of Batman merchandise and memorabilia, enough to open my own toy store, practically. And so that was really my reaction and experience to this film, even though I can distinctly remember feeling more of a kinship to the Burton and Keaton films, particularly Batman Returns. There was something still cool and exciting about this particular entry that, you know, it sort of goes over your head at that age, you know, 4.5, 5 years old, the idea of, well, it's not really the same universe, but it's kind of the same storyline. There's a different Batman. Like, none of that sort of registers, at least to me, at that point. I was just enjoying the ride of another Batman movie, and this film is certainly that. I often think of Batman Forever as an amusement park experience, and I mean that as an endorsement of the film. It has all the bells and whistles that we would associate with going to any amusement park. You've got your roller coaster, you've got your Ferris wheel, you've got your fun house, your house of mirrors, your junk food, the cotton candy, the popcorn, all of that. It ends with fireworks, and you just feel great. You can be a little exhausted by the end of it, but you still have a fulfilling experience by the end of the day. And that's sort of how I always look back at Batman Forever, whereas Batman and Robin, the sequel to this film, is an amusement park ride on acid. And there's a big distinction, because sadly, I think the films often get interchanged, but Batman Forever is a much darker, serious take on the character, as opposed to what we got in the zany, campy exploits of Batman and Robin. Batman Forever is a fun, fulfilling experience, but it does have elements of psychological complexity that the later film did not have. But overall, this is an enjoyable experience. You have a great time watching Batman Forever. Again, you can be a little worn out by the end of it because it is a lot of nonstop propulsion and excitement and things going on in a thousand different directions. But all in all, like any trip to an amusement park, you have a great time and you look back on it with fond memories. Now that I've reflected my own thoughts on this film, let me take us back to the Batcave and review the film properly. Val Kilmer takes over for Michael Keaton as the Caped Crusader. This time, he is facing off against not one, but two villains. Two-Face, played by Tommy Lee Jones, who apparently could not sanction the buffoonery of Jim Carrey, who plays the Riddler in the movie. There's a whole interesting behind-the-scenes drama where Jim Carrey, I guess, and Tommy Lee Jones did not get along, and I think a lot of it was just the difference in their acting styles and approaches to playing these characters. But you can certainly find Jim Carrey's quote verbatim where he says the exact line that Tommy Lee Jones could not sanction his buffoonery on the set of the film. But putting that all aside, putting egos aside, this is also the film that brought Batman's sidekick Robin into the fold, along with a new love interest played by Nicole Kidman. Now, the story begins with Batman attempting to capture a recently escaped Two-Face, who takes the Caped Crusader on a helicopter ride from hell. Right off the bat, we are thrown into the action. Yes, pun intended there. Meanwhile, Bruce Wayne must confront a series of riddles sent to him by a disgraced former employee, Edward Nygma, who, as I said, will eventually become the criminal mastermind known as the Riddler. When Two-Face disrupts a charity circus, he slaughters the family of Dick Grayson, Chris O'Donnell, rendering him an orphan and putting him under the care and guidance of Bruce Wayne, who tries to direct the young man away from a path of revenge. The story runs parallel to Bruce Wayne, who is also dealing with his own psychological reckoning, aided by his relationship with Dr. Chase Meridian, who has her own confliction and emotional attachment and romantic feelings between Batman and his alter ego, Bruce Wayne. However, all of this comes to a head when the Riddler and Two-Face team up. They capture Chase Meridian, requiring Batman to team up and join hands with his younger protege, who eventually becomes Robin. The dynamic duo are finally together on the big screen in a story of heroism, valor, courage, and ultimately justice. Now, Batman Forever is a tribute to the larger-than-life era of the character's incarnation, particularly back in the 1950s. You think of the Dick Sprang era, the larger-than-life aesthetics and designs. That's very much a part of this Batman story, this world of Gotham City. It is not Batman Returns in the slightest, nor is there even a hint of it being in the same realm of Batman 89. However, I sort of look at it, if the Batman 1966 series and Batman 89 had a child, Batman Forever would be the offspring. And again, I mean that as a compliment, because there is certainly a lot of campier elements with this film, infused with a sort of a sense of pop art and excitement, all the while having little dashes of psychological resonance. So it's kind of a melding of the both worlds. It definitely leans more into that sort of fun, campy aesthetic of the Batman mythos that started in the 1950s, certainly reached its peak in the 1960s with the Adam West TV show. But there are elements, if you will, like with the psychological backstory that's sort of hinted at in this movie. It's not fully explained, and I will get into that in just a little bit. But certainly the film is a much more audience-friendly and accessible film than its predecessor. I mean, namely, you look at the casting, particularly that of Jim Carrey, who was a major up-and-coming comedic superstar at the time. That, of course, you have the addition of Kilmer and Kidman to the cast, along with Chris O'Donnell. There's an overall vibe shift with Batman Forever. It's cooler, it's sleeker, there's almost an MTV kitsch to the whole affair. And again, there is a 90s sort of aura to it that definitely, you know, could feel dated, but there also is that hint of nostalgia, particularly when you go back and revisit it after many years, which is what I did for this particular episode. Now, there is a sort of an infusion of neon and bright colors that sort of add to this saying, this is not Batman Returns, this is not Batman 89, it is something new and different. It's still the same character, but it's a fresh take on the character, so to speak. And I think the visual distinctions are both important and impressive. The gothic aesthetic of the Burton films are gone. This film is larger than life. It almost has a Greek influence that allows it to develop its own identity and themes. Now, is this a perfect film? No. I will be the first to say that. And I think of this era, thinking of the four Batman films that define the 1990s, Batman Returns, for me, is still the tour de force of Batman in this era. On the con side of this film, you know, putting aside more of the lighthearted elements that are definitely more prevalent than in the previous two Batman movies, one thing I think is Tommy Lee Jones. And I won't say it's a miscast, but his character is both underwritten and underserved, and he ultimately feels like a poor man's Joker. And the character, of course, that he's playing, Two-Face, is a psychologically complex, disturbed character that I think under the right script and direction, Tommy Lee Jones could have brought something really terrifying and tragic to this character. But he just sort of comes off as a Joker wannabe, and it's almost is in direct competition with the zany antics of Jim Carrey, who, frankly, he steals the show in this movie. And I think he ultimately works perfectly in this world as a slightly, even perhaps more unhinged version of the Frank Gorshin take on the character from the 1960s show, which was over the top and zany. And Jim Carrey seems to be channeling that, but it works much more effectively than sort of Tommy Lee Jones' Joker half impression, as opposed to the more tragic and psychologically unhinged version of Two-Face that the character has been in the comics, and I think was perfectly done in the Dark Knight under Aaron Eckhart. But again, we won't go down the road for the Dark Knight trilogy, because if I get started, we won't stop. Certainly, the film does lack a little bit of the moodiness that Keaton brought to it. And I think Kilmer, to his credit, doesn't try to do a Keaton impression, but instead makes his Batman his own version. Whereas Keaton was much more the silent guardian type, much more stoic. Kilmer is kind of the heroic crusader, and I thought that was a unique distinction and sort of establishes two different takes on the same character that is still very much in keeping with the character's history and mythology. I mean, again, there's other nitpicks I could certainly lob at this film. It is much more joke-oriented, and there's a lot more humor infused into the film, which, I mean, again, there's nothing wrong with that. I certainly prefer a much darker, grittier take on the character, and certainly coming off of Batman Returns, there is a noticeable difference in the way this film is projected, particularly from the gothic lens. But putting that all aside, and again, being a student, if you will, of Batman history, I can appreciate this film for what it tried to accomplish by offering a different side, if you will, of the Knight. Whereas Batman Returns doesn't serve its story, its plot, its characters on a silver platter, Batman Forever does the opposite. And again, that's not a knock against the film, it's just a different way of approaching the story. It is pure movie fun. Again, the larger-than-life situations, the propulsive action allows us to see a different side of the Caped Crusader, different take on Gotham City, if you will. That all goes back to the director, Joel Schumacher. Again, he was certainly maligned after Batman and Robin, but when you look at the task that he was given for this film, specifically, he met those objectives. He was hired to create a more family-friendly version of Batman, and he succeeded in that regard. You know, Batman Forever may not be my preferred take on the character, but I cannot deny the objective that it set out to achieve, and it did so to tremendous success. The film was a huge box office hit back in 1995. It was one of the highest grossing movies of the year. And so, again, you look at it in the context of what it needed to accomplish. Yeah, it did its job, and it did its job well, so much so that we're still talking about the film 30-plus years later, or almost 30 years later. And again, I look at the moments in this film that really stand out to me. I mean, whether it's Batman in the Batwing bursting through the cloudy sky, giving Commissioner Gordon the thumbs up, or the Batmobile climbing the side of a wall, very reminiscent of the old Adam West show where Batman and Robin would climb up the side of a building to get in through a window. But I think the moment that probably sticks out the most to me and what I most associate with this film is the teaming up of Batman and Robin, their iconic handshake, and the official moment they become the quintessential dynamic duo that's been a part of the character's history from 1940. I mean, people sort of forget that, but Robin has been a part of the Batman story from practically the beginning. And so this kind of felt like a real full circle moment for the character's history to bring Robin finally into the fold. And while personally I prefer a Batman who was a solo operator, I can't deny Robin's importance to the Batman story. And this film definitely achieves that. And in a particular way, the way the story, or Robin's story, contrasts with Bruce Wayne, there's really this parallel journey about the need for, or desire for, vengeance and the restraint, particularly that Bruce Wayne has, and trying to shepherd that experience on to Dick Grayson and ultimately Robin. It's really a perfect moment and very poetic in sort of the overall story of this film. Now, as I mentioned earlier, this film is not, it is a sequel to the previous two, but I would not call it a direct sequel, though there are subtle nods to the other two films. First, Chase Meridian, who, again, played by Nicole Kidman, wonderful addition to the Batman world. This was her only appearance in this series, but she was a wonderful inclusion in this film, and her character as a psychologist really helped emphasize the psychological underpinnings of this particular story. But her character makes a subtle nod to a skin-tight vinyl and a whip. That's clearly a reference to Michelle Pfeiffer's Catwoman from Batman Returns. And then later on, when Bruce and Dick are talking about vengeance and the death of their respective parents, Bruce specifically refers to his parents being murdered by a maniac, and clearly that's a nod to the Joker, the killer of Batman's parents in the first film. Now, again, those are subtle nods that I think kind of tie these films together in a way, in addition to the appearance of Michael Goth as Alfred, who was in the previous two, along with Pat Hingle as Commissioner Gordon, who was also in the previous two films as well. So there is almost like a feeling of this being a truncated trilogy in a way, or at least a thematic trilogy, because the way this story explores the nature of vengeance and sort of Bruce Wayne coming to peace with it, so to speak, and sort of reconciling with his past, there's very much a kind of a through line with what starts in Batman 89, continues on into Batman Returns, and then ultimately sort of reconciles and concludes itself in Batman Forever. And I think that parallels nicely with Dick Grayson, who was all about revenge and trying to get the killer of his parents, and comparing that to what happened with Bruce. And he was successful in defeating, killing the killer of his parents, but it didn't solve anything. It just made his pain grow and made it worse. And I think that's a nice way of tying these films together in a way. I mean, certainly, yes, would it work better if it was Michael Keaton all the way through and the aesthetic of the Burton stories? Sure, but I appreciate the sort of the thematic connection between the first Batman film all the way to this film. Now, as I said at the start, Batman Forever and Batman and Robin often get interchanged, but this film is no lightweight. There is a real story underneath the action pieces and the poppy, high-concept adventure, and it's a story about the consequences of revenge and vengeance, the need for healing. And Batman Forever really puts it out there for the first time in context, this idea of Bruce Wayne wrestling with the idea if both he and Batman can coexist. And again, if there's one knock, I guess, I could put against the previous two films, is that Batman as a character often doesn't have a full arc, if you will. And certainly, you know, as I said, there is that through line between the first film and all the way to here. But Forever, again, 10 years before Batman Begins, put the character under the microscope and try to get to this idea of what exactly makes Batman tick, what makes Bruce Wayne tick. And I love that there is a line later on in the film, once Bruce Wayne has sort of come to peace with his alter ego and his existence just as an ordinary guy, where he says, I am both Bruce Wayne and Batman, not because I have to be, now because I choose to be. And I thought that was a real great arc for this character, and brought him sort of full circle from where it began in 1989 all the way to this film. And again, certainly the way this movie sort of peels back the mask, if you will, it was a first attempt to deconstruct the character and really examine just what made Batman who he is. Now, there was a whole subplot to the film that sadly was removed. So, I mean, much of the psychological underpinnings are gone in the final film. There were flashes of it there, but there was a whole entirely separate storyline that really wrestled with this idea of just what made Bruce Wayne become Batman. And it retold the origin in a way where it sort of reframed it and put it into fresh perspective. And I know there are versions of the film. It's largely referred to as the Schumacher cut. I am hopeful that one day it will get an official release. I think now that we are in the 30th year of this film, the fact that it is still widely celebrated and appreciated, I would love to see what was Joel Schumacher's original version released in an official format so people could see just what the original intent for this movie was going to be, because certainly people have been quick over the years to just brush this off as it was Batman and Robin before there was Batman and Robin, and that's not the case, because even though much of the psychological elements are muted in the final film, there is still this important story about reconciliation and vengeance and justice. And while it's there in flashes in the final film and it serves the story, the ultimate real purpose, the germ of the idea, was largely left on the cutting room floor. So I'm hopeful that one day that will see the light of day and it can be experienced as the film was intended to be, because certainly what we see in moments here, particularly as Bruce Wayne is sort of dealing with these flashbacks and nightmares about the death of his parents and whether or not he is responsible in any way, those are real powerful moments and themes that, of course, other movies would explore and carry on to full extent. But here it was in 1995, retelling, reimagining, if you will, the origin of Batman in a way that had not been done up until this point. And certainly, again, to someone who always appreciates a darker, grittier take on the character, I would love to see this version given a full official release. And so here's hoping now, with the 30th anniversary upon us, that it will finally see the light of day. But here's hoping the higher ups at Warner Brothers will hear this plea and at least honor the original vision by director Joel Schumacher, because clearly there was an attempt to really explore the psychology of Batman and Bruce Wayne in a way that had not been done before. And again, while it's not there as much in the final film, you can see, especially through the deleted scenes and the original scripts and outlines, where the story was ultimately intended to go. And I think it would be much more fulfilling to see it finally released so people could appreciate this film. Because, as I said, in 30 years, Batman Forever is one that continues to grow in esteem and affection. I think partly because there is that nostalgia. It is very much of the 1990s, but yet there is something compelling because there's also that other version to this film. And again, that really brings me to my final point on director Joel Schumacher, who was often maligned for his handling of the Batman series. And again, while Batman and Robin is garish and borderlines on being tragically comical, Batman Forever got it right. It was a course correction, if you will, from Batman Returns, which was attacked and derided by angry parents who didn't like the fact there were Happy Meal toys associated with a dark, serious, adult-oriented Batman movie. You had, as I said, prototype Karens and little kids who were clearly told what to say. Look, I said what I said. To their credit, Warner Brothers looked at the bottom line and they decided, well, we're going to do a a U-turn and a slight readjustment of the Batman franchise. And again, while I prefer a darker, grittier version of the character, and again, certainly I've gone on at great length in the past about the Dark Knight trilogy, I cannot deny that Batman Forever is a successful reinvention that, yes, lightens it up a little bit, but still feels like it is being true to the dark roots of the character. I mean, again, that's why I go back to the idea, if the Batman 1966 show and Batman 89 had a child, the offspring would be Batman Forever. It really is a molding of both worlds, where it's a little silly, it's lighthearted, but there is still some darkness and complexity to it that everyone can enjoy and appreciate. That's why I think of it as an amusement park experience. And again, oftentimes that's a horrible label to put on a film, but this case, I think it really does describe it perfectly, because it has the thrills, it has the excitement, it has the exhaustion. Yes, it can be a little bit over the top. Jim Carrey could sometimes go overboard with his take on the Riddler. But all in all, you leave at the end of the film, as you would leave at the end of a day at an amusement park, with a sense of excitement and fulfillment and just of having had a great time. And that's how I always feel when I watch this film. I enjoy what I'm watching. It delivers a thrilling Batman adventure. Again, it may not be what I prefer from the character, but I cannot deny that it is an exciting and enjoyable thrill ride that, as I indicated at the top, it is part of the character's history. And this is not like it was a wild, out-of-the-box reinvention. It was a course correction, but it was still in the tradition of the Batman mythology. And so 30 years later, I applaud this film. I hope one day the extended cut will ultimately see release, the Schumacher version of the movie. But other than that, Batman Forever is still a, pardon the pun, a bat-tastic time. And I also think it says something that 30 years later, we're still talking about this movie. I mean, I guarantee you, in 30 plus years' time, there will be many, if not the near majority of, say, Marvel movies, will not register in the same realm of appreciation and retrospective as Batman Forever. And I think that is a testament to the fact that this is a well-made film with a great cast, a compelling story, and an engaging audience experience. And again, I'm not trying to knock Marvel in any way, but I think there's a reason why this film has managed to hold its place in the pop culture sphere, whereas a lot of other comic book movies in the years since have just sort of come and went. And I think that's a testament to Batman Forever because, well, let's just face it, Batman is forever, both in name and in certainly in this film's case as well. And finally, I want to pass this along. I'll leave all the information in the show notes, but there is an organization called Real Outreach, and this charity's purpose is to try and give the theatrical movie experience to underprivileged kids. So these could be children in foster homes, group homes, or sick in a hospital who might otherwise have never experienced going to see a movie in a theater or would be unable to see newly released films in the theater. And right now they're doing a fundraiser to try to help get as many screenings for the upcoming Superman movie to bring kids who would otherwise be unable to go able to see a film in the theater. And I think this is just a wonderful organization to support. Even if you can't chip in, if you're able to share this link, I mean, this is what I mean when I say for the love of movies. I love what this organization is doing. And if even if you can just share it along, it helps build awareness. It can get to have as many kids to experience the theatrical movie-going experience. So I leave that with you on this particular Friday. Again, all the information is in the show notes for this wonderful charity. Thank you, as always, everyone, for tuning in. I'll be back next week where we'll do this all over again for the love of movies. Phil's covering every movie dream. Phil at the movies makes every movie.